You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. When it comes to jobs that are overlooked, misunderstood, or just flat out not talked about, few of them are as maligned as the editor. Now, publishing as an industry is notoriously tight-lipped about its practices, business model, ethos, so it's a rare treat to have a frank conversation with someone inside that world. To the average reader, an editor is the person who sits with a red grading pencil and corrects all your grammar and spelling mistakes and perhaps suggests a better way to word a sentence here or there. There are people who wanted to be middle school English teachers, but for grown-ups and with slightly higher stakes. From the writer's perspective, the editor is a god, or maybe a demigod, or at least some kind of wizard. They are the gatekeeper to the magical realm of publishing. They decide what manuscripts get turned from dream to reality. And to the author who's been behind the velvet ropes of publishing, the editor is so much more. They're your advocate when it comes to marketing. They help connect you to new and interesting resources. They bounce ideas off you, you bounce ideas off them, and in the best of scenarios, they can become friends. Like my guest today. Now, usually I don't know my guests, but today is an exception. I've actually known today's guest since 2020 when she bought my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, and gave me my big break into the mysterious world of traditional publishing. Hannah Robinson has been an editor at some of publishing's biggest houses, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, where we met, and now Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette. She primarily works with nonfiction, which is a massive slice of the publishing pie that seems to get all but ignored on social media. We had a discussion about what the job of an editor is, what it isn't, and whether they're the scary gatekeepers aspiring authors make them out to be. And because I couldn't resist, we talk a bit about the making of Dabbler's Guide and why certain things did and didn't make the cut. Here's Hannah Robinson. Hannah Robinson, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, Dom, thank you so much for having me. I am flattered and excited, and I just can't wait to chat with you. This is such a treat.
Full disclosure, listener, this is a very full circle experience because normally I don't have like a personal relationship with my guests, but I have both a personal and professional relationship with my current guest because Hannah Robinson was my editor for my last book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft.
Yeah.
And I am so pumped and pleased for you to be here. So for folks who do not know you, because most of the time people that do your job are very not public people, very behind like an iron curtain of secrecy. So tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
Absolutely. No, it's a strange experience to step out from behind our authors. So I am an editor. I work at GCP Balance, which is an imprint of Hachette Book Group. And we specialize in practical nonfiction. That is my official title. When I describe what I actually do, I often think of myself more as like a book midwife. That better encompasses the scope of what editors are responsible for in a publishing house.
So what is the job of an editor? Because I feel like for people who haven't gone behind the velvet ropes of publishing, there's this idea of what an editor does. So what
from your perspective, is the actual job of an editor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is definitely the perception that we are all sitting in cozy armchairs with great lighting and reading manuscripts. And like, I admit, that's what I thought I was getting into when I first started in this business. That is not what we do. What we do is a lot broader than that. So editors are responsible for carrying through books from idea all the way to shelves. And that looks like meeting with authors and bringing in potential talent, working with them closely on the manuscript, and then managing the publishing process. So we wear a lot of different hats. A huge component of my job is project management and, you know, making sure that the marketing team is talking to the publicity team, is talking to the sales team, is talking to the production team, and that this fantastic idea that we have all invested in and this amazing human who we've all invested in makes it to market in a really impactful way, and that they're reaching their readers, and that when this book goes on sale, we know we've put together a successful campaign for them. So we get to wear a ton of different hats. It's like, you know, I already kind of said midwife, that's that like ushering process, right? Like you help someone through that stages of this gestation and bring something into the world that's purely their creation. And that's such a gift. I'm also sometimes a therapist and a hostage negotiator and a brand strategist and all sorts of fun things. It's a good time. We have a lot
of fun. Editors get to wear a lot of hats, especially I'm sure at a bigger imprint, you get a little bit more clout, a little bit more capability. I am curious though, because it did say at the beginning there that that a lot of people have misconceptions about what an editor's job is. So I'm also curious about what isn't an editor's job.
Oh goodness. That is a great question. A really hard one to answer, because in the publishing world, a lot of things are the editor's job. I would say some of the things I don't handle are like, you know, where is the paper coming from to print your book on? Like, I don't do inventory and operations. You know, I don't handle some of those like direct sales calls, but you know, the joy of being an editor is that we get to do little bits and pieces of everybody's job. So if there's something that needs doing, kind of falls to the purview of the editor, you know, except writing the book for your author. That's the author's job. That's their idea. You help them, but ultimately it's their book.
Could you make that part of your job, writing
the book? I mean, we can work something out. We could, yeah.
Writing is hard, Hannah Robinson.
It is.
Now, speaking of, you know, somebody's first draft is obviously not the final, not what makes it into the final book. And oftentimes the version of a book that you are pitched might be wildly different from the final product. How do you know when a rough draft that you're reading has a diamond inside of it? And how do you know when a rough draft is something that you, a collection of words?
Oh, that's such a diplomatic way to say that, Don. So I'm a metaphor girl. Let me put it in that framework. So like, I often describe the writing process as like making pancakes. And when I first bring on an author for my list, because I work in nonfiction, it's all on spec. It's proposals, it's outlines, it's a couple of sample chapters. And then we realize what the final book is going to look like together. It's really, really collaborative. The first phase of that is kind of like the ingredients, right? Like we've all sat down, we're like, great, we're going to make pancakes. You need some eggs, you need some milk, you need some flour. What order are we going to put them together in? How are we going to do that? Fantastic. We make some batter. And then that first draft is kind of the first pancake. And what I'm looking for is like, when I take a bite, when I'm reading this manuscript, does it taste like a pancake? Does it look like a pancake? And then you notice like, okay, the pan might be a different temperature than it needs to be. We're going to reorganize some things. Maybe we need to cook it a little bit longer, maybe a little bit shorter. There are lots of little wiggly pits that we get to work on together. And then we add finesse. What often I'm looking at very specifically is like, are the ideas solid? Are they thought through? Mm-hmm. Is your argument clear? You know, like what is it that you wanted to say to a reader? And are you doing that? In prescriptive nonfiction, which is what I work in, I'm also looking at like, how are you guiding the reader? Do you have something in mind for them? Are they on a clear trajectory forward? How are they going to take that next great step? And if those things are in place, we can usually work together and find something that's really just like tweaking, reorganizing, getting in the weeds together and kind of finding like, okay, if we turn up the pan like 2 degrees, we're going to get a better pancake. Let's do that together. Sometimes we got to go back to the batter and see like, okay, maybe we need to do some more thinking. Maybe we need to find a different way to assemble these great ingredients so that what comes out is something that readers are really excited to sit down and have brunch about.
There's a difficult piece of that, which is where you thought that somebody wanted to make pancakes with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they brought you an omelet.
Yeah.
And they said, you know what? I'm really interested in omelets, though. I've suddenly become just absolutely besotted with the idea of omelets.
Yeah.
Do you find a middle way? Do you find, is that the editor's job to find a middle way? Or has there ever been a time when you say, you know what, this is actually not, I don't know that this is something that I can do. This is not the, I don't have the bandwidth to handhold you into figuring out how to turn an omelet into a pancake.
Mm-hmm.
We need to, either you need to get some outside help, or maybe we need to rethink this project. Maybe we need to rethink breakfast.
Yeah. It really depends on the project, right? So my stance is always that this is the author's book. This is not my book. I know what I can sell effectively to readers. It's my job to know the market, to know the best version of the book that we've incepted together. But if you are really committed to that omelet life, then like maybe there is a different publisher who would be right for you. Often what we do is really talk it out, find a middle ground, renegotiate our menu a little bit and say like, okay, what if we did like French toast? What if we find like a version of this that works really well for the audience we have jointly imagined and that's really aligned with their needs, their interests, and who the author is and the way that they need to tell their story and present their information to the reader. A lot of negotiating. I'm glad to say very often we're not in that position where someone's delivered an omelet and we were all making pancakes. So it's rare for me, but we have to negotiate sometimes.
From your perspective as an editor, as somebody that buys books that aren't written. And I think that might shock people to know that there's a huge amount of the publishing industry that is sold on spec or that is sold on an outline, on an idea, on bravado.
Yeah. Yes.
In full disclosure, the book that we worked on together, that was not written. That was written, we got a contract and wrote it afterwards.
Exactly.
Which is very normal in nonfiction. So how does a writer know that they are ready to become an author? How does that person know that they've got the skill set, they've got the chops to take that next step from your perspective?
That's a terrific question. I like to see authors whose book have kind of been living in them for a long time, right? Like when we get on a call and I'm saying like, what brought you to this moment? Right? Like, why now? What prompted you to sit down and say like, you know, it sounds really good. I want to write a book about this now. They have a really clear answer for what that next step is going to be for them. Often the authors I'm working with have been doing work in their field for years, decades. It's often a lot of original research and they're ready to present it to a trade audience. A lot of my authors are also, you know, therapists, doctors, social workers, folks who work one-on-one with people and realize that what they're doing one-on-one, they really want to impact more people, but they only have so much time and they're ready to scale to reaching hundreds of people at a time, thousands of people at a time in a way that they can't, you know, one-on-one in session with a client. Those are the folks who are at that tipping point. The other thing I'm looking at is what someone's platform is, you know, and I hate to have to bring in that dirty word into this conversation because it's so fraught and it's so complicated. But it's someone who really has been doing the work the whole way along and building that great following, building a rabid fan base who's like, I want your book. There are people clamoring for this so that when we bring it to market, they're really excited, they're really motivated, and there's kind of a built-in group of folks who listen to them speak, who listen to their podcast, who, you know, follow them on socials, who listen, you know, subscribe to their newsletter, all of those components together. So it's a few different factors all at once. The thing I always tell authors, though, is that you are also committing to a full-time job on top of whatever it is you're already doing. I just thought, everyone listening, you didn't just see Don like sigh and heave himself toward the microphone, because it's true. It really is true. It's not, it's not a fun side gig. It really is a full-time commitment. And knowing that about how it's going to impact your income streams, potentially, how it's going to impact your caseload, how it's going to impact what you do day to day, is a big factor. And kind of folks who have all those chops in place, who are really ready, have those ideas, have that audience, and are also at a place where they can take on, you know, the real work of writing and publishing a book over the next essentially 2-3 years. Is kind of the folks who are ready.
So you mentioned platform, and I know I know that there's going to be people that listen to this that one might see my current platform and hear the word platform, and they think I need to have influencer level follower counts on this, this, and this social media platform. Because one, they know you were my editor. Two, I currently have a certain number of large followers. I do need people to know that you bought my book back when I was barely a blog. I had been doing stuff for a long time in a community, but that's the thing, is that I think when people hear they have a platform, they need to understand that a platform isn't one particular size, depending on the community, depending on the niche, depending on the topic covered. You could be a community leader. You could be a really experienced charity leader, and you want to write a book about teaching other people how to start doing charity work in their local community. That doesn't mean I have to be a charity influencer with 500,000 followers making videos about me going to my food bank or something like that. Like a platform doesn't, a platform is just, I have been doing the work, and there are people somewhere that will vouch for the fact that I have been doing the work.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's such an important reframing of that. The way I think about platform, you know, and every editor is different. Right. Like there are a lot of nuances to this conversation. But one of the things that I think about is, who is going to be out there as an evangelist for you? Like, who are the folks who are really dedicated and committed to the work you are doing, and who will show up for whatever you're doing next? And that's the way that you build your platform over time. The other thing I think about is, like, what's the range of your platform? What's the diversity in your platform, right? Like, people really get hung up on how many social followers you have. And I can tell you that the conversion rate on that is not necessarily as high as you'd think it is. It's really tricky. And there are many, many instances where I see more conversion success when someone puts up there, like, my book's now available for pre-order, please go buy it, from folks who have a more modest following, just pure numbers, but everyone's really invested in their work, than the folks who have, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers who are interested, but maybe not quite as, like, ravenous for what it is that you're putting in the world. So thinking about, you know, you have your social following, that's kind of great digital real estate to take up, but do you have a blog? How many people read it in your case, right? Like, that was huge. Do you have a newsletter? Do you speak at conferences? You know, I work with a lot of academics who don't necessarily have what we would think of as, like, consumer-facing platforms, but they have incredible incredible connections within their own communities mm-hmm. that they leverage really effectively. Or business leaders who go do talks at every organization under the sun who are happy to show up and buy books as part of that. So there are a lot of different configurations. Owning your audience is the most important part, no matter where it's spread out. And being able to evidence that the people you have will show up is what I look at. And then beyond that, it's really just the size of the platform just impacts like maybe what the events level is. And that's
sure. And I think a lesson that I've learned from getting the platform that I've gotten is that the only thing that any of those numbers mean is potential visibility. Mm-hmm. It's potential mm-hmm. visibility.
Yes.
It means that when I post something, it has the potential to be seen by a few more people than it used to have. Mm-hmm. But I've had blogs, I've had social media posts, I've had things go crazy viral when I had no following. I've got a big following now. I'll post something and nobody will see it. And it's like nothing is guaranteed.
Exactly.
And you were talking about conversion rate. Mm-hmm. I talked about this very openly last year mm-hmm. after my own book, after Dabbler's Guide, saw a super viral moment in which a video, it's that moment that every author dreams of when a video about their book hits the algorithm for all the right reasons and millions of people see it and it shoots up to Amazon charts. Mm-hmm. And I was the 154th book in the world for like a week. And I was number one in like 37 categories and all of that. And I'm like, do you know what those millions of views and what that number all actually equated to? It was like 650 books sold 1 week and like 470 mm-hmm. books sold the second week. Mm-hmm. And I still had a day job.
Yep.
So what it did, was it got me visibility with other authors. Other people mm-hmm. took notice of me. It told me, hey, maybe now's the right time to change your agent. Maybe you mm-hmm. could use some of this clout and collateral to make your next move. Yada yada, but that doesn't translate into that conversion rate. Millions and millions and millions of views, hundreds of thousands of comments, 600 books sold.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the reality.
Yeah.
It's really hard to keep in perspective.
And that number is actually pretty good for most genres most of the time.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. In a week,
it's
pretty good.
Yeah. 600 copies in a week.
If your book sold that many copies in a week, every week, forever, you would make a tidy mm-hmm. royalty check. It mm-hmm. would not suck. It'd be mm-hmm. fine.
Everyone would be very happy.
Everybody would be very happy.
Very, very happy.
And if you could just keep doing that, you would not go hungry. Yeah. I do want to talk about some of the power structures, because again, I think that a lot of people, especially prospective writers, but anybody mm-hmm. in a creative field that understands what it's like for you to be an outsider and to just think of the various respective gatekeepers mm-hmm. to a creative career.
Yeah.
Editors are people, agents are people, but I do want to go up a level and talk about mm-hmm. the publisher, because something that you said earlier is like, okay, we're all making pancakes here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I am, but what a lot of people don't realize is that an editor works at an imprint that makes mm-hmm. pancakes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you picked my book up at a place that said, okay, we're going to make pancakes and sometimes we're going to make orange juice, but we're going to be mm-hmm. all making breakfast here at this imprint. Sometimes publishers say, you know what's more lucrative than breakfast? Lunch.
Lunch.
Yeah. We all need to make lunch now. Mm-hmm. What do you do when the publisher just suddenly decides that you aren't making breakfast anymore?
Aha. So I want to, you know, it's a complicated answer, because mm-hmm. the way imprints are structured is that they do have very strong identities in what they work on. So, you know, when I think about publishers, like if we're going to kind of continue this metaphor, like they're running the restaurant. mm-hmm. right? Like every imprint is contributing a component of that. And so if I'm, you know, part of the brunch unit, there, my colleagues are in fiction, maybe they're responsible for like happy hour, you know, like mm-hmm. that's their space.
Of course fiction gets happy yeah. hour.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Like it's fun. Who doesn't love that? So, you know, and there's no particular rhyme or reason to this one, but every component of the restaurant menu is essential. And sometimes the publishers have to rebalance, like, where are we making money, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is their job. And what I think is hard to square up sometimes is that in publishing and in many, many, many creative endeavors, the creative component butts right up against the capitalist component, where we are a for-profit company and we are responsible for making money for the company. And that mm-hmm. is at every level, right? Like as an editor, I am responsible for bringing in a certain amount of revenue for my company. And so when I am acquiring books, those are part of the expectations that come in with that. And publishers are responsible for helping determine what they think the balance needs to be so that we are effectively driving profit as a company. And sometimes that's really, really aligned with what folks want to be doing creatively in a given moment. And sometimes it is not, right? And that in a given moment is the part I want to emphasize, because readership tastes change over time. We see so many cycles of things pass through every genre. Fiction, nonfiction, doesn't matter. There are patterns to reader behavior. And sometimes what we notice is selling really well looks like X. And then sometimes like, well, actually people really are into like, I don't know, bacon this season. So we're really gearing our menu around this. And then in a few years, we'll be back to tomatoes. No problem. But there is a real kind of dance that happens between the creative components and the financial needs of the company to be able to realize both fully. And editors get to kind of sit in the middle with their authors really aligned with the creative component and also fully engaged with the financial component and trying to bring to market what will sell most effectively.
As an author that has gotten to know a lot of different kinds of authors and a lot of different kinds of genres at a lot of different kinds of levels of success, mm-hmm. One of the things that I wish that I could get prospective authors to understand, because some of the pieces of advice are, okay, we'll see what's selling and see how you can put your spin on it, which mm-hmm. is not the worst advice, but the caution there is that the books that are out now that are currently mm-hmm. trending mm-hmm. were bought 2 years ago.
Correct. Yep.
So if you are writing to what is right now mm-hmm. and not trying to think about what is next, or just mm-hmm. what do you have to offer mm-hmm. free of whatever is trending, you are already 2 years behind.
Yes. Yes. I cannot more emphatically agree with what you are saying. And, you know, it's true even in nonfiction, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're writing for like, everyone's talking about breathwork, right? Like if you're seeing a lot of breathwork books coming out in the market right now, you know, those are books I acquired 2 to 3 years ago. We're on looking for like, what's going to come after that. Mm-hmm. In the fiction side, I hear my romance colleagues in particular talk about this, where it's like, okay, what's going to be like the new hot sport? Hockey is hot right now, but what's going to come after that? What are we going to chase
what's after Dragon?
Trend?
What's after exactly. fairy porn?
Exactly. 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 And like, you know, as someone who sits on the editorial side, those are all the questions mm-hmm. we're asking constantly. And as yeah. I read submissions, that's what I'm looking at and I'm thinking about it. As an author, it's a careful dance to do between like seeing opportunity, knowing your genre, knowing your market, mm-hmm. know your readers, know what they're into, what they're reading, and where that conversation lives. But also you have to write your book, right? And like there are so many examples of folks who went for years submitting a book, submitting the same one, and then finally found that right editor who had mm-hmm. the vision for it. And it becomes hugely successful. Sometimes it's a time game. There's nothing wrong with your idea. It's mm-hmm. just not in the right moment. Sometimes it does need retooling. And that's okay mm-hmm. too, but you can't just write for what you think is going to publish tomorrow into the, you know, paperback table of your favorite indie bookstore.
Yeah, even if it's a very rushed timeline, if you're seeing what's trending and you finish that book and it sells in the spring, it's not going to be out there in the fall. It just is not.
No, it is not. Nope.
So talking about power structures, editors and agents are often thought to hold all of the power over an author's career. Is that true?
I hope not, because that takes
all of the power, Hannah Robinson?
Oh, God, no. No, no, no. I don't know. I should ask you that.
Do you have a trunk in your apartment where you keep all the power that you hold?
Absolutely. I only take it out on special occasions. Very critical. No, I mean, that's a great question for me to flip back to you, right? Like, do you think that I hold all the power, or held when I was functioning as your editor, all the power over your career?
No, God, no, no, no. But there is an element of, I can't, there is a power exchange.
Oh, absolutely.
I need you to give me, and that, but then I need to give to you. But something that the entire process taught me is that we are all, like you're saying, we are all chefs in this kitchen making a thing. I do have to do the bulk of the labor to make the thing. But that's kind of why I asked right up top, like, your job is to help make sure that I end up with pancakes, you know, and if I start veering off into another direction. But also, you know, I think that what you've said previously is the writer ready to be an author? Is this the right idea right now? Like, all of those things, like, that all comes together. Yes, there's an element of gatekeeping, but gatekeeping isn't bad in the sense that, like, not everybody is owed a writing career. You might want it really bad, but you are not owed it, and you are not entitled to it. And I think, not to jump all the way into this whole other discussion I don't even want to have, but that's where things like ChatGPT, Midjourney, like all of those AI things, I think give people this idea that there's this cheat code to, I can skip being bad and I can just make good. And because I am entitled to finished, publishable, good work that other people will want from me.
No, it's hugely complicated.
I mean, there's gatekeeping. And yes, I would love to see more yeses in my inbox that I have. But also, I have learned over these last several years that no is oftentimes a grace, and that sometimes a quick yes ends up being something that I regret down the road. You know, I've had to part ways with people in my career before. My current agent was not always my agent. You know, I've had times whenever I've had to realize, okay, no, I do get to have more power in this situation. I don't have to be beholden to an agent or an editor or whatever.
Exactly.
And I've had times where I say, I feel very strongly about this. And you've said, okay.
Yeah, exactly. There is a real dance here. And in, you know, there's the ideal world, and then there are some of the realities. In the ideal world, like, the agent, the author, and the editor are like the core team, right? Like, what I want for you as my author is very aligned with what you want for yourself. We both want to sell the shit out of your book, right? Like, we want to make sure that the readers who are excited about it are seeing it. And your agent wants that for you too. And they're there to make sure that you have a good match with your editor, that the publishing house is there. They're there to make sure your contracts are fair. All of these really important pieces are in place. There is absolutely gatekeeping that happens in publishing, and it's something that I know many, many, many of my colleagues are pushing up against. I also do want to give, you know, myself and my colleagues the grace that we can't say no to let me say that again. I really want to give myself and my colleagues the grace that, like, we can't say yes to everyone who wants to write a book. And that is really challenging for a lot of us. But again, going back to that, like, creativity, capitalism dynamic, we only get to do so many books a year. And if I have to place my bets on, you know, what's going to break out, what's going to sell the best, what's going to be the most award-winning, what's going to be the most kind of groundbreaking and transformational for readers, I only get a handful of those a year. I see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of proposals over the course of a year, and I only get to publish somewhere between like 8 and 12 books a year. And that's like maximum bandwidth, and that's true for my colleagues as well. So there are a lot of no's that are really challenging. And I think for any author, what I wish is that they find someone who can give them that really strong yes. That means more than just the opportunity to kind of see your book in a shelf, because you're getting a different level of partnership. You're getting a different level of care and attention and vision than, you know, kind of like quick, yes, we're just going to put you on a conveyor belt and then your book's in the world, but you didn't really have a publishing experience around it.
You know, I when people talk about this kind of dynamic about success and power and all of that, and you know, gosh, I'm so talented at this, why aren't I seeing success? I'm actually really glad that stuff like singing competition shows exist.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yes.
Because like, if anything, stuff like American Idol and The Voice have proven to us that there are like, you think Christina Aguilera is the only person that can hit all those notes? There are so many people out there that can do that, that have just been toiling away. Mm-hmm. They're your kindergarten teacher. They're a lawyer. They're a doctor. They're a janitor. They haven't had access. They haven't had time. They haven't had luck. They've been plugging away and it hadn't worked, or they just never thought it could be for them. They just assumed that this kind of career was out of reach. I thought I was going to be a poet forever. I thought that was the only thing I was ever going to be. I thought that I couldn't get through an entire manuscript. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that in myself until somebody else helped me see it for myself. But like, there are so many people that are so freaking talented out there.
Yes.
One, you're not the only one. Two, the thing about the people that are really freaking talented is sometimes the reason they aren't successful is because they want to do a thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not that that thing's bad. It's that that thing isn't selling right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's people who are amazing jazz singers.
Oh,
amazing jazz singers. When you hear them, you just want to weep.
Yeah.
But also, that's not really what's playing on top 40 right now.
Nope.
That isn't really what's like in the zeitgeist. That isn't what people are doing TikTok dances to, you know, that kind of thing. That isn't that major breakthrough success. And it isn't that what you're doing isn't good. It's just it isn't able to be sold right now. And the people that sometimes break through are saying, okay, I do this, but if I'm willing to do this, I could sell something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could find success.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think, you know, to bring it back to authors and writing, it's where you as a writer need to learn to kill your darlings. Yeah. You need to learn to stop being so precious with your vision, and you need to realize that sometimes other people do want you to succeed, and they might know a thing or two about helping you get there.
I'm going to put that on a bumper sticker.
Thank you so much.
It's true though. It's true. We all want you to be successful. Mm-hmm. At no point does any editor want their book to die on the vine. That is like, that is so contrary to what we're here to do. And it, you know, success looks different for every author, for every book. Not every book's going to hit the New York Times list. Like, there is so much about that list we could talk about another time, but like, that's not the only benchmark of success for any book. And being really clear with yourself as a writer, like, what do you want? What is success for you? What does success look like for your publishing team? Listening to that and getting really clear on like, what is it that you want your book in the world for can really go a long way in your process and in, you know, the anxiety of submitting projects to agents, the anxiety of having your agent submit to editors, the anxiety of working on a book and then having to turn it in 9 months is it crushing sometimes, but kind of all along the way, knowing that you have a team, knowing that that team's on your side, and being really clear about what success looks like for you will transform your experience.
From your perspective as an editor, as a gatekeeper, mm-hmm. how do you hope that writers deal, how do you hope that writers receive rejection?
It's a really good question. I hope that they receive it as feedback about the project, not about them as a person, because it's really not ever about you as a person. There are, as we've been talking about, sometimes there are products that come on and like, I can pitch this to an entire room of colleagues, to my higher ups, to their higher ups, and make, you know, really make the case, the business case for why this book will sell and the ways in which it will sell. Sometimes there are beautiful books that I love that maybe it's just not right for my list, right? Like I see a lot of memoirs. I don't publish memoirs. So it's not about you. It's not about your story. It's just that that's not the kind of book that I publish. That's not my genre. So I have to say no. The most gorgeous memoir in the world, I would still have to say no to. The most gorgeous novel in the world, I am not going to publish that.
I know, right?
Like coming home to roost very personally with us. Like I love your work. My imprint, right? So there's a certain amount of that happens. And anytime I'm saying no, very often it's, you know, if it's about platform, it's not yet. It's not, I don't like your work. But it's not personal. It's really not about you, the human. It's about this project and the capacity I see for it in the market, given the time that I am considering it.
Nonfiction,
yeah,
is a huge part of the publishing industry. Most years, it's the biggest part of the publishing industry. If you're just dealing, you know, 50-50, it tends to be more, more years than not. Why do you think that places like BookTok and Bookstagram and other bookish social medias pretend like nonfiction doesn't exist?
Isn't it the worst? It's the worst.
It's so weird.
It's the worst. No, with great love for all of my BookTok humans, they are doing the Lord's work, bringing back, you know, projects we haven't thought about in a long time. But, you know, it's a really tough one to answer. I think that people have a lot of preconceptions about what nonfiction is and what it reads like. And, you know, not for nothing, some boringness through what they likely read in school. And that may have been their only exposure to nonfiction. The other thing is that a lot of folks online who are publishing in nonfiction, particularly in my world, they already have their own platform. There are different spaces in that. So I think that there's a certain amount of ability to go to those folks directly for their content. You don't need someone to be as much of a kind of spokesperson in that casual way, but people love fiction in that BookTok world. They just really, really, really love it. If anyone listening has ideas for how we can break nonfiction into that world, please call me. I would really like to know. There's some new strategies.
There's this idea that fiction provides us an escape from our horrible world that we live in. And nonfiction just can't do that because it's about the world that we live in. Do you think that's true?
I struggle with that one a little bit. I mean, certainly depending on the kind of fiction you're reading, it can feel like an escape. I think the escape comes from being so absorbed in something that you are in flow. You lose track of time. You're in a different space than what you were experiencing yourself previously. I am very much of the school of thought that like all reading is a learning opportunity, and fiction is about learning through stories and empathy and understanding different worlds and, you know, the kind of play that can happen there, the exploration that can happen there. And then nonfiction is learning in a more fact-based way. You know, even in story, it's still, you know, memoir, personal story, those sorts of things. It can feel different, but I've read plenty of nonfiction that feels escapist to me because I get to step into someone else's reality for a while. But yeah, who doesn't love being able to just like let it all go and sink into a really delicious space?
Well, that's true. But the thing is, I think when people think of escapism and fiction, they think of something like fantasy, a comedic romance, something like that. And when they think of nonfiction, they think of dry history. They think of a civil war or something or other. And I'm like, I have not laughed as hard at most fiction as I have reading Mary Roach talk about dead bodies.
Right? She's like, so good.
That woman is a genius. I hate her. Also, she follows me on social media now for some strange reason that I cannot figure out, and I'm going to beg her to blurb my next nonfiction book. So there you go.
There you go. There
love you, Mary Roach. If you're listening to this, I don't actually hate you. I just authors understand. Like the biggest compliment that one author can give to another is fuck you. I hate you. Mm-hmm. And I threw your book across the room last night. That's like the biggest compliment.
But look, it's that big, dramatic reaction.
If I ask a writer friend, like, hey, what'd you think of those pages I sent you? And they're like, oh, I really liked it. I'm like, oh, God, what's wrong?
Oh, no, you hated it. Oh, no.
Yeah, you hated it. Yeah. And if they're like, first of all, how dare you? I'm like, yes! Yeah.
Nailed it. Exactly.
I have a personal question, and it's a little bit of a personal beef.
That's all right. Tell me.
Just about writing. Okay. And about what I love to write, really deep down in the deep dark pit of my soul. Yeah. Why does nobody like poetry?
Oh, friend, it's so hard. It's so hard. I know.
Why does publishing hate poetry?
Oh, friend, I know. We struggle with poetry. We really, really do. And it's so. God, like I'm thinking of one colleague right now who's just such a smart poetry editor. And just like, it is so hard to break poetry out because of reader taste. And I don't, you know, the people who love it are there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, we were talking just a second ago about how hard it is to get people to go from like escapist rom-coms set in deliciously magical places and get them just to like, I don't know, pick up a comedian's memoir, which could be equally delightful. It's that one step further into like something that might ask more of you, could give you more. But I think that you need to read poetry. For myself, this is purely it. We're like, you need space around that. You need space to enjoy it, to ponder it, to understand like everything that's happening kind of around the poem and in your emotional world. And it's really hard to get people to deal with their feelings. And so I don't know that everyone's like chomping at the bit.
Poetry
for that
asks
one,
a lot of its reader.
Yeah.
It doesn't provide all of the structure that people are used to. And also, and I talked to the poet Taylor Molly about this.
Yeah.
Sorry. Let me just get that over, just brought that over there. But I talked to Taylor Molly about this. I'm a poet as well. And I think the problem with a lot of poetry and the reason why people don't read it is because they're just so traumatized by the horrible, outdated poetry that they read that is the only poetry that is taught in schools. And it's like, no shade to Robert Frost, but my God, could you get somebody that has published in the last 20 years?
It might kill the school districts to do that. It might be too challenging.
Literally
they would have
anything.
A lot better.
Okay. I do want to ask some fun questions because I feel like listeners of the show, you were my editor. I do have a book with you.
Yes,
we did make a child together.
We did.
I do feel like I need to do a little fan service and talk about The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, which came out September 28th, 2021. Why'd you choose it?
Oh, it's such a good question. I have a real soft spot for kind of the spirituality universe at large and thinking about the ways that we interact with all kinds of belief. And when I saw the way that you wanted to talk about witchcraft, I was like, I am so in for this. I love that blend of science and spirituality and fun and real. Just enjoyment and real commitment to like the realities of magic and the gatekeepers of magic. Like, you got really in there. It was like, this is so smart and so fun, and I just needed it to live in the world. Like, from our first conversation, I was like, Dawn's amazing. We need to do this book. And it really was such a delicious and wild ride to be on with you in getting to realize it. Because if I remember correctly, like, from our first conversation, it went through a lot of different iterations, kind of coming through different outlines and different, like, brainstorming sessions.
I literally made that initial outline because I got an email from somebody that worked at Simon & Schuster. And I was like, there is no way this is real. This is a scam. But I told some friends and they were like, okay, but what if it's not a scam? And Simon & Schuster is emailing you. And I'm like, what if it's not a scam? And I remember very nearly hyperventilating in the gym, because all of everything that I do is at the gym. And I made that outline, that initial outline, which I'm sure you could tell, in the gym on my notes app. Mm-hmm. And I emailed it to you.
Look, I mean, this points very clearly, like, first thought, but how impressive. And, like, truly, we can tell as editors where things came from and when and on what timeline. And seeing that and being like, this guy just sat here and, like, fully formed, sprang onto this page, these bullet points, has such a great perspective, knows exactly what he wants to say. Like, we need to talk.
You were talking about earlier, there, you tend to work a lot with people whose books have been living inside them for years. Mm-hmm. And I remember those first conversations. I said, I would love to write a book in this space. You would not want to publish the book that I would want to write in this space. Nobody would buy this book. It might piss people off. Like, I just don't think anybody would read this. And you're like, try me. And I was like, okay, here is exactly what I would want to talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I vomited out an outline that had been, I'm just like, this is all the stuff I just need to say. I just have got to say it. Yeah. And you were like, great, let's do it. And I, what do you remember? So talking about all of the iterations.
Yeah.
And I did say up top, and I'm raising my hand here, that somebody's first draft is not... It shares DNA, but not much else with the final draft. Do you remember anything from that first draft that sticks with you from those early pages?
Oh, friend, you are putting me on my memory on the spot from a few years ago now.
A fun memory of mine.
Please.
Is that I remember emailing you and saying, okay, I've never done this before and I'm very nervous that I'm going to shit the bed. Mm-hmm. As I finish chapters, can I just send them to you? Or as I finish, it wasn't chapters. I think I did it in sections. As I finish a section, can I send it to you?
Yeah.
And you tell me if I'm like a terrible writer or not. And I would send that to you. And you never emailed me back.
No,
you didn't. Not about the sections. Like, you waited until the full script. You
were just like,
thank you so much. Keep going. And I was like, wait, no, am I a terrible writer or am I doing writing? Am I a terrible writer or am I doing writing? And you did not tell me. You did not interfere. And I was just like, okay, keep going. It was bizarre. That first draft was 74,000 words, I want to say. Yeah. And I was in a fever dream, like, writing that book.
That sounds like the experience of a lot of authors, getting on the ground feedback as you go or not. And what I will tell you is that, like, it is both beneficial and challenging sometimes when you get that feedback along the way, right? And the way that editors can work sometimes best is to see it all at once. And then we can see, like, oh, I see what you were doing here. I see where you wanted to go with this. Because if I see it in part one and I'm like, where's that headed? I don't know what's going on with that one. Not necessarily bad, but then I can see it come to fruition. Like,
well, and see the lesson that I learned there is that writers need writer friends, authors need author friends. And so as you're drafting, you need, like, alpha readers, like people, yeah. your inner circle of other yeah. writer friends that you can be like, okay, here's this chapter. Does any of this make sense? Before I send it to my agent, before I send it to mm-hmm. my editor, does this mm-hmm. even make sense? Do I need to scrap mm-hmm. this? And like, those are the lessons you take.
I didn't know any of those yeah. lessons. So I was just like, hi, Hannah Robinson, is this bad? Did I do it bad? Can you please
bad. For me? Exactly. It's tough. No, look, like writing sounds like it's going to be this very like exciting, really creative, very confident process as you're like, oh, I've had this book living in me forever. I'm just going to sit down at a Word document and like bang out 70,000 words, no problem. Have a great vision for this. And then you sit down and you're like, I don't know if I just wrote that in English for the last three chapters. Like, someone please advise. And to an extent, like, yes, your editor is here to kind of be like a test, kind of sit between you and the reader in that. And the other piece is like, yeah, you need a lot of like friends going through that same experience and having that sense of community in real time and supporting each other can be so important and really beneficial for writers, like through every single step, right? Like, because there's a lot of author anxiety and writer anxiety that happens and is so natural when you're putting your brain and your heart and your creativity and parts of your soul on the page for other people. And then suddenly you're like, wait a minute, I don't know what's on there anymore. Like, I'm really freaking out. I need someone to like help me understand what's happening, assuage my fears that things are still readable, that it's okay. It's not that you're going through this process and it's okay. That's tough.
Was there any part of the book that surprised you?
I loved all of the little pop culture references that you brought in. There's this great, like, Legally Blonde moment in the book. I was just, like, obsessed, could not love this more. We are keeping this in. Like, this has to stay. Yeah. That, to me, remains one of the most, just, like, you know, scroll down to the next page, read this line of, like, heck yes, this is just everything. And like, it's no small feat to braid so many different, really interesting, really nuanced components of the world into one really cohesive narrative. It takes a lot of thought, takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of talent from you to be able to do that. And just watching the way that you were like, yeah, we're going to call this in. I was like, okay, I'm here for that. That is not what I expected to be on this page, and it works, and I love it, and it stays. We need this in my life.
There was, so, but speaking, you know, calling back to the beginning of this conversation, sometimes what is in that original outline, sometimes what's in that first draft does not make it to the final draft. And something mm-hmm. that I remember, and I have hinted about on social media before, mm-hmm. and I've told people in comment sections that this happened, but I've never actually yeah. talked about what happened, is there were entire fully researched, fully written mm-hmm. chapters of Dabbler's mm-hmm. Guide, entire yeah. chapters
yes.
that made it through beta read, that were in the arc, maybe, or at least a couple of, at least one of them was in the arc, that were deleted.
Mm-hmm.
And that mm-hmm. wasn't your call. It was mine.
That was the
first time that I realized I had power and agency over mm-hmm. this whole process. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was not the right person right then to write that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So like mm-hmm. we had a whole chapter and it was in the first section and it's what ended the first section. And I thought it would be a good way to take it from people's misconception, because we start the book with people's misconceptions about witchcraft and modern spiritual practitioners. And we start that with media and we go through a little bit of history and politics and yada, yada. But that first section ended with a discussion, like a 1,000-year mm-hmm. history uh-huh. of the concept of black magic, white magic, where all that came from. It was one of the most heavily researched chapters in the book. Mm-hmm. It took me months of research, tons of calls with other friends of mine who were historians. And that, I think, made it into the arc even. And it was just through long conversations where I was like, I just, it does have to cover so much ground in such a small amount of space. And it's not that I can't stand behind these words. It's just, one, I'm not sure I'm the right person to write this right now. Two, because it has to cover so much, there is so much that then gets left out. And you hope that your reader will give you the grace to know that you're going through the high points, but you also know that your book is going to go out there and it's going to live on its own and it's going to be on social media. And you were like, I'm here to include it. It's a good one. I'm here with you for it if you want. But at the end of the day, it became a single little paragraph in another chapter. And I think the book was better for it. And you think, oh, my word count is going to, I've got to cut an entire chapter. I've got all my word count. No. The book ended up being like 96,000 words.
We had to cut a lot.
And we had to cut a lot.
To that. You had a lot to say.
We cut down to 96,000 words. Yes, like we cut down and then we added two.
Yeah.
Like there was an entire chapter, I think, on like there were entire chapters towards the end that became other chapters and got mushed where some things shouldn't have been a chapter. It got squished into like there were three or four chapters that became one chapter.
Yeah.
And all of that.
Yeah.
How'd I handle that? And is that a typical experience? Is that something that other authors deal with as well?
Yeah, I would say that's extremely typical. I don't find that, you know, it's interesting when you outline something and you're like, yeah, this is how it's going to sound in my brain. This is how it's going to sound in the roadmap. We've kind of talked through it. And like that sketchy first version of like, here's kind of generally what it's going to look like. Once you get into it and you start writing it out and you realize like, oh, wait, and then I have this source and then I need to talk about this thing and then I need to talk about this thing. And then suddenly you've written like 20,000 more words than you were expecting to. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you're so close to the material that it's hard to discern, like, is this essential to the journey the reader is on? Is this essential but could be paired differently with other things? Like that's the gift that I get to come in with, kind of my first read objectivity, and say like, huh, okay, what if we did these things differently so that the reader follows this narrative a little more cohesively and clearly and comes in. It is tough. It is so hard to hear like, but I did all this work. Like what do you mean that it's not going to be in the book? You handle it beautifully. I heard you ask that question. I think you handle it with such grace and collaboration. And, you know, it's not dissimilar from what we've been talking about with the whole publishing experience, is like your editor is here to help you shape the book that will be most appealing to your reader. Mm-hmm. And that is a collaboration and a discussion and kind of an ongoing labor together to find where that's going to be while honoring, like, this is the book that you need to write. This is what you have to say. And also, what do we know the reader's attention span is going to be? What do we know their interests are going to be? What do we know their like familiarity with the topic is going to be? And like, where can we work together to kind of push and pull and combine things so that what ends up in the final product is, you know, the best version of that book that we can see.
I'm going to ask you a question, then I'm going to answer the question, but I want you to think about the question.
Okay,
is there anything that we cut out of the book? Is there anything, and I know it's been a few years ago, so if you can't remember, is there anything that you cut that we cut that you wish we'd left? And I have my answer because I've been holding on to it for years.
Okay, tell me.
In the middle of that big chapter, which I think probably is what sold the book. The in the middle of the big chapter on you know, the ethics of dabbling, and we talk about, you know, gatekeeping, the big sociology
of
chapter,
the big one,
the big one,
that chapter so much. Yeah,
I wrote this, but there's this very long section that covers some really tough ground with the reader. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd built up a lot of we'd earned the right with the reader by that point to do a long slog. And I'm kind of known for taking tough, deep topics and finding a way to at least let the reader laugh through it. but there was just no way to do that in this section.
I said,
okay, look, this was tough. This is a lot of information to digest. Mm-hmm. So here are some Halloween themed dad jokes.
Oh yeah. I remember. I feel like to share those with the audience, like dig them up and share them.
Girl,
as an addendum
to
because they were good jokes, let's be clear, they were very funny.
Listen, here's my, this is, I've got it right here.
Yes,
okay,
it's
right,
it's
here,
it's really appropriate. I'm always here for a dad joke.
I wonder if I even so while I'm looking for this, I wonder if mm-hmm. I can even find mm-hmm. it.
Yeah,
that's, oh, they're spotting a fraud. Was there anything that you can think of? Anything that you remember? Just big, small, anything that came in those first couple of drafts where you're like, maybe we could have taken a chance, rolled the dice.
You know, I think it's the piece that ultimately, I mean, you were just talking about that we cut out, which, like, I ultimately really agree with your decision to do it. I think it was also very well researched and very thoughtful. And I still think about that part of the book that is not actually part of the book sometimes mm-hmm. because of the real work that you put into it and how careful you were. Again, still think it's probably like for the ultimate good of the book that it didn't make it the final cut. But as the first thing I'd see on the cutting room floor, that I'm like, that was just really, really good. That's the one that comes to mind for me. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to figure out what's in there and what's not. I admit, as an editor, very rarely do I end up in situations where it's like, wow, I just really miss this piece of the book. Because when I have that feeling, I try to make sure that things stay in, because I have a feeling readers would miss them too. It's hard.
Okay, I can't find it. So that means it's not meant to be.
That's all right.
I'll find it somewhere. Well, I'll text it to you. We'll laugh.
Oh, yes, please. Yeah.
Did it help you? Did the Dabbler's Guide mm-hmm. help you believe in magic?
It certainly did. I can tell you. Oh, okay. So you know how I sent you the video?
You sent me where you did the bottle.
Uh-huh. I did the bottle. And I was like, first and foremost, I just need to see if this works because I have questions. My like science brain could not quite wrap my head around like what this was going to be like. But in the real spirit of like, I firmly root myself in the idea that belief is what governs your life, and what you believe in and what you put your like real self toward has a major impact on your lived experience. Varying levels of like magic that come into that. But I was like, you know what? Here's one I'd like to try. Let's do this. So I sent you this video and I did it with all my magical intention. I was like, let's see if I have some magic. Let's see if I can make this happen for myself. I can tell you that spell worked. I will not tell you what it is, but it worked beautifully. And I have since like decided I used my magic. I need to save this for very, very important circumstances. I have not tried that one again, but it lives in this very, very happy part of my heart where it was like, I really needed something to stop. And I did this spell and it worked. And I believe in magic. I'm very confident being on that side of things. My faith in magic is strong.
There was a time, I should have asked this earlier. There was a time during the writing process in mm-hmm. which I asked you a question mm-hmm. because I was just personally curious, because you know I'm very investigative and I'm very into facts and mm-hmm. making sure that people are saying mm-hmm. true things and that everybody's operating mm-hmm. in good faith. And I remember asking you what fact checking was done on me and what mm-hmm. what if any fact-checking was done on the book, and what if any fact-checking is typically done in nonfiction, generally speaking. And I know you're a very special kind of editor that not everybody gets. And I remember where you told me, well, there were certain parts of like the spell canvases and stuff at the end that I ran by a science editor because I wanted to make sure that you weren't like gonna poison people.
I wanted to make sure we were good.
And there was a thorough vetting of things like quotes and dates and names and did this person actually say this and all of that kind of thing. And there were times when I had to go back in and add additional citations because it was like, okay, well, there's not enough here. You know, I remember like the Pat Robertson quote. Could I actually see the Pat? Did he actually say this? Or are you paraphrasing? Yeah. So I had to like go find the actual original interview and send that to you and stuff like that. So generally speaking, especially with spiritual nonfiction, just from a general perspective, how much fact checking is done in the industry as a whole? And why is it not as much as people think it is?
Yes. So the industry standard is that we do not fact check our books. We are not journalists. We are not the New York Times. We do not have that standard of fact checking. There are a number of reasons for this. There are some really great articles about this. So like anyone who's really like wanting to dig in, I fully encourage you to read them. A lot of it has to do with the way that authors are responsible for the content of their books. And there are some very complicated legal reasons why that has to be the case. The reality is that, you know, especially in the parts of the publishing industry that I work in, which does a lot of like spiritual nonfiction, practical nonfiction, things where it's like, we really want to make sure that we're not recommending something harmful. Every editor has their own bandwidth. I have a very strong do no harm kind of philosophy about the books that I publish. So there's a lot of leeway in that, but I definitely want to make sure that the recommendations that an author is making are not likely to cause harm to the person reading the book or to the people around the person reading the book. But that is not an industry requirement. And so you get a lot of really fascinating books in the world. And, you know, maintenance phase, personal favorite, love seeing what they dig into. And if books could kill, not to sell up other podcasts on your podcast, but like some really fascinating examples of like, you know, books where fact checking is not required, having a real impact on their readers in ways that perhaps are not to their benefit. It can be very, very problematic.
I think correct me if I'm wrong, that typically publishers will maybe go into fact checking from the publisher if it's one nonfiction and two, if that advance starts having lots of zeros at the end of it. Because it tends to be CYA on the publisher's part where it's like, okay, we are giving you a lot of money, which probably means we're going to make you very visible. So we just want to make sure that what you say in the book is. And I think that has to do with, if I'm not mistaken, some mistakes from the early 2000s were things like, you know, something little things or whatever. Like, you know,
what could that book have been? There are just a few examples of that being potentially problematic for the publisher. You know, it's a complicated one, right? And there is a meaningful difference between fact checking as like a journalistic endeavor and an academic endeavor, and the way that like if you hire a fact checker, which some authors very much do, and there are definitely circumstances where a publisher will say like, I need you to have this fact checked, but it's not, you know, ultimately the publisher who is responsible for that process. There's a meaningful difference between that kind of work and the work of, say, a legal vet, which we do quite regularly, or copy editing, which has some light fact-checking in it. You know, the copy editor is going to look and be like, hey, I think that actually happened in, like, 1978, not 1988. Is that a typo? Like, you know, those sorts of light opportunities. And it does depend very much on the content of the book, I would say. If you are publishing some really heavy hitting political journalism, you're going to need a fact checker. If you are, you know, recommending some new diet strategies that maybe are not FDA approved, but don't have to be, it's probably not my bailiwick, but it's not required that the publisher or the author would go through that process. The credentials of the author would, to an extent, kind of stand in for that. And then we put a nice juicy disclaimer at the front that says, in fact, we are not responsible for the content of this book or its impact on you.
Speaking of credentials, that was also something that I asked you about. Did you fact check my degree? Did you fact check any of my bona fides? And you said no. But if you said that you were like a doctorate of anti-gravity or something, you'd be like, okay, well, I've never heard of that. And that doesn't sound like a thing.
I have questions. Exactly. Yep. There's a certain amount of like, kind of casual scoping that happens. And like, if you say you have a degree, I'm looking up your degree. If you do not specify, because that's not part of how you're selling yourself, okay, then how else are we building up your trust and credentials and what qualifies you to speak about this topic? Separate from kind of the fact-checking mission that does often happen for my authors, but you were in the clear.
What are some ways that the publishing industry has changed since you've joined it, and how, for good or for ill, and where do you see it going, and what kind of changes do you wish to see in the industry?
All great questions. A big one that I have seen, actually really just dovetailing with that credentials thing we were talking about, is that the way readers establish trust, speaking specifically for like nonfiction, practical nonfiction, has a lot less to do with kind of the letters after your name. And I see an increasing emphasis on voice for better or ill. Like, is this someone that the readers like hearing this information from? And, you know, that's a whole separate conversation about whether that's to the good or the ill, but there's a big shift in the way that readers like to hear information, the voice they like to hear it in, the way it's presented to them. You know, when I first started about a decade ago, many, many of my books didn't have a lot of like interstitial illustrations or sidebars or fun things to kind of break it up, because people just read long pages of text. That's not really true anymore. Mm-hmm. The biggest one, I think, is audiobooks. That has really revolutionized in such happy ways the way that consumers have access to the books, the way they interact with the books, the way they get to hear an author's voice. Like, it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite changes that has happened for our industry. You asked also the way I see things going and what I wish would happen. Yeah. You know, I see a really continued change toward author platform, and I hate to bring it back to that, but it becomes more and more important as that kind of consumer, direct to consumer promotion is what moves the needle on book sales. And publishers haven't yet cracked the code on how to be that direct to consumer voice. And so we lean heavily on our authors across fiction and nonfiction to bring their audiences with them. So I see that really continuing to ramp up as we fight it out against all of the other direct-to-consumer opportunities that exist in our world. And what I wish we could get back to a little bit is that real basis in like the quality of the creativity and the ideas and how beautiful the books are that we get to see. And even the ones that get away or we don't get to publish, but that we as editors and publishers get to witness in their infancy. Like, there are so many good ideas. There are so many good ideas. And I wish we had more space to share them with other people.
Hannah Robinson, normally this is the part of the show where I say, where can people find you? But in your very specific instance, with your very specific job, people should not try to find you, because it's not going to go well for them, because you can't take submissions.
I cannot.
You can't. Yeah. Don't email her. Don't DM her.
I love getting a chance to interact with folks, but you are correct. Usually I am on the very secret side of the desk.
A little bit. Well, thank you for allowing us a peek behind the desk. Mm-hmm. It is such a joy to get to introduce you, somebody that I adore very deeply, to my audience, because you really have been such a big transformative part of my life.
Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you for being
such
here.
I feel like I've seen you through so many different phases of
which
your
was your favorite haircut
journey.
Of mine? No.
Oh my God. Later. No, it's such a joy. I'm so just touched that I get to have this conversation with you. And thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest and friend, Hannah Robinson. Now, normally I would tell you to go follow her and support her on social media, but this time you can't. So, However, you can follow and support me, because if you like the show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. That word of mouth is honestly the best organic way to grow the show. You could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you, and I check them from time to time, and they make me so happy. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and you get to help me like select questions for guests. Sometimes you get like a cool bonus features. Earlier this summer, they got a free book. My next collection of poetry is already completely finished, so I just gave it to my Patreon supporters. There's the unpublished chapter that we talked about, that Hannah and I talked about. I posted that for my Patreon supporters. So you can sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod, or you can also connect with me on social media. I am at headonfirepod everywhere. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for downloading the show. Thanks so much for all of your support. I'm going to go, but remember to never stop seeking illumination, like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.